Welcome to the People's Historians Podcast from the Zinn Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. In this episode, from our series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle, our host, Jesse Hagopian, a high school teacher, speaks to Brooklyn College professor of political science and author, Dr. Jean Theo Harris, about a recent article, Martin Luther King Knew That Fighting Racism Meant Fighting Police Brutality. The two discuss the liberatory vision of Dr. King, the all-too-prevalent sanitization of his politics, his struggles against racism in the North, and the way his life and beliefs are often mistaught in school. Jesse starts by introducing Dr. Theo Harris.
We are very fortunate this evening to be joined by Jean Theo Harris, a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College. She is the author and editor of numerous books, including some of my favorites, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History, and also The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and the new YA edition of it, which I highly recommend educators get for their classroom. She is also the co-founder and collaborator on this series, and is a true people's historian in her scholarship and her practice. So welcome, Jean.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. But I do feel like we need to have a moment of just like what a hard week it's been. It's been a crushing week, I think, particularly for educators. And so I just wanted to hold space for a second just to say, it's so hard. And if you're feeling like it's hard, please understand you're in community together with us tonight, because it just, we think we've seen the most disrespectful thing, and then we see something else even more disrespectful. And so.
I know it. The attacks keep coming on hardworking educators.
Yep.
And it seems like our health and safety is not the priority for these school systems and for the broader country. So it helps to be in it together, though, and have some comrades in the struggle. So I'm glad people have joined us in this community.
Yeah, me too.
Right on. Thank you for starting us with that acknowledgement. And I'm really excited about this class today because we really have to win back the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., right?
Yes, we do.
We're in a struggle for his legacy right now. And because everybody seems to want to claim him, right? I mean, you have the left claims him, liberals claim him. I remember seeing a McDonald's ad growing up that was like, you know, celebrate Martin Luther King at the same time they're not paying a living wage to their workers, right? Yeah. And then today you have even the far right, anti-critical race theorists, I like to call uncritical race theorists, they claim him as well. In launching the Anti-History 1776 Project, President Trump even said, quote, there's no more powerful force than a parent's love for their children. And patriotic moms and dads are going to demand that their children are no longer fed hateful lies about this country. We embrace the vision of Martin Luther King, where children are not judged by the color of their skin, but the content of their character, right? And so this quote from King is repeated ad nauseum. And I just wanted to ask you, why is Martin Luther King claimed by people with such different politics? And I'm also curious to know what you think King would say about the struggle over critical race theory today, and what King would want students to learn about in school today.
Well, I mean, I think to start off, I think we want to remember that this kind of sea change, like, is not true when he dies, right? So somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans don't approve of King, don't approve of his work when he dies. And we're going to see that sort of flip by 20 years later. And for people who are interested, I sort of talk about this in A More Beautiful and Terrible History, that part of what we see is, from the very beginning, we see this push for a King holiday by his civil rights activist, Coretta. And there's all this pushback. And then we get to kind of the 80s, and Reagan, President Reagan, had been a longtime opponent of the holiday, but he's running for re-election. And he starts to see it as a way to win over moderates. And so interestingly, that opposition changes to sort of support. And we see Reagan sign the federal legislation making the third Monday of January a holiday for Dr. King. And I think that's a really important moment, because I think if we look at kind of what Reagan says that day, and he talks about, and he kind of puts forth this kind of American exceptionalist sort of idea of King that I think then lies at the heart of the way that everybody feels like King would be, you know, they would be friends with King, they'd be protesting with King. And that's this idea kind of that in most countries, right, Dr. King wouldn't even get to speak at all, but that like in a country like the United States, when you shine a light on injustice, right, then, and you do it the right way, then it changes, right? And King and Parks are kind of the poster children for this idea. And so what I think then happens is that King becomes a way to celebrate kind of the robustness of American democracy. And so then everyone claims him because he seems to sort of stand for American progress. And I think one of the most misused quotes of King is the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Because I think that tends to be sort of used in this like narrative of progress way, right? That we might still have a long way to go, but we're just constantly progressing. And King himself took that to tap. I mean, King eviscerated this idea. He called it the myth of time, right? And he basically is like, time is neutral. Basically, and I'm paraphrasing him, the forces of evil have used it better. And that there's nothing like, you know, things only progress through our actions. And this notion that America's gradually progressing towards more and more justice is not true. So in many ways, I think there's this way we hold on to that quote, because I think it gives us like hope in hard times. And I think there is a way that obviously King is a religious man, and he's talking about kind of the God of justice, but not the way that we tend to misuse that quote, which is like this narrative of like just constantly getting better and better, which is, I think, one of the key ways that King then gets used by both conservatives and liberals to basically be like, we had a problem and we've largely fixed it, and yay, America.
Right, right, right. Yeah, absolutely. So it seems to me that's just such a great framework for how we got to this situation where everybody claims him and most people really misuse his legacy. And it just is galling to see how many times the right use a couple of quotes out of context. Absolutely. To attack critical race theory in schools. And they're gearing up right now to celebrate MLK Day as a way to attack kids' rights to learn about structural racism.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. And one of the things I think we're going to talk about today, and kind of is the heart of why we decided to have this session, is the new book that I'm working on, which is really looking at Dr. King's longstanding understanding of Northern racism, or racism is not a Southern problem, but an American cancer. And therefore his understanding from the 50s onward, not just in 1967, right, of kind of a structural racism in this country, that racism is not about hate or meanness. And again, I think some of King's like quotes about love tend to get misused to kind of like obscure how he understands racism fundamentally as structural, and the ways that he also understands that the South is often used to shield like Northern liberals. And by North, what King would mean would be Northeast, Midwest, and West Coast, right, from grappling with the racism endemic in those places. And so part of what we're going to be talking about tonight is kind of all of this this is where my research has gone, and just really uncovering this whole other side of King that I think we're so much less familiar with, and how long he called out Northern liberals, how long he stood with Northern movements. Because I think we tend to sort of see King only taking on Northern racism in the last years, right? Post Watts. And that's just not the case. And so we can talk about that, and I can share some resources on that. And because in some sense, I think even as much as I think we all have tried to get outside of the myths of King, one of the things that I've been really grappling with in this new project is how much there's still ways that we tend to buy into things about King, like King kind of being this like Southern respectability politics guy, when over and over and over, he's calling out these kind of behavioral solutions as not solutions, right? That personal responsibility is not public policy, and what you need is public policy, and calling out the police and the courts, and seeing kind of the situation in Northern cities as a system of internal colonialism, and seeing, you know, racism as being about profit and materialism, right? And this is the King that I think we want to sit with and learn more with, because I think he really speaks to where we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that so many teachers will be emboldened after our session today to lean into teaching about structural racism, and know that King would have your back in that struggle. And I can't wait to dig into more of what he thought about some of the other struggles in the North, for sure. But I want to also take a look at some of his views on, you know, what he would think about Black Lives Matter and the police.
Yeah.
In some of these, you know, the call to defund the police.
Right.
Today,
right. Yep. Yep.
That I think has really captured people's imagination. And so in this wonderful book, More Beautiful and Terrible History, you quote King saying, "When we ask Negroes to abide by the law, let us also demand that the white man abide by the law in the ghettos. Day in and day out, he violates welfare laws to deprive the poor of their meager allotments. He flagrantly violates building codes and regulations. His police make a mockery of the law." Right? "And he violates law on equal employment and education and the provisions for civil service." So give us context for that quote and what King's attitude would be to the police and systemic racism.
So I think the first thing to remember, I mean, there's a couple of things just to really remember from the outset. The first is that King has a lot of experience with police abuse and police misconduct, right? And that King is arrested 29 times. And he is often roughed up in those, and some of them are caught on tape. So if you've ever seen, in 1958, he goes, Ralph Abernathy is on trial for something. Him and Coretta go down to the courthouse in Montgomery to try to go see. And they arrest him for loitering. And then there's a very famous picture where he's like basically half Nelson, and they've pinned his like arm behind his back, and they have his head down on the counter. And this is in front of a photographer. And then they arrest him and they take him back to the cell, and then they rough him up in the cell. You may also have seen when he gets arrested in April of 1963, right, where he go in Birmingham. And you may remember when he's getting arrested, they lift him off the ground. I think one of the things that I've done more lately that is to kind of go back to things we think we know and to watch them again, right? So what it means that to have the police pick your body up, right? King was terrified of the police. And I think we forget that, like, what it takes to get arrested time after time after time, because the first time he's in Montgomery, it's during the Montgomery bus boycott. He gets arrested for speeding 5 miles over the limit And then they take him into their car. They don't just give him a ticket. And then they drive him around. He thinks he's going to be killed. So from the very, you know, that very first counter, like, he's terrified of the police. And so what it takes for King to be able to sort of do this over and over and over, I think we sometimes forget that. So that's the first thing I want us to do. The second thing is, I think sometimes we tend to think about King's critique of the police being about Southern racist police, right? And part of why Jesse just read that quote and why I think it's so important is because he's talking not just about the police as like bad individuals, but a kind of structure. So when he talks about this sort of system of internal colonialism in Northern cities, he calls the police and the courts enforcers of that system. He talks about the ways that police abuse. So after the Watts uprising, he writes this piece where he's like talking about how disillusioned he is, like, because he's often welcomed in these Northern cities, but the minute he starts talking about Northern injustice, then only the language is polite, is what he said. And then he writes, as the nation, Negro and white, trembled with outrage at police brutality in the South, police misconduct in the North was rationalized, tolerated, and usually denied. And in fact, he had been calling for change in the police. So a year before the Watts uprising is a 6-day uprising in Harlem. And the mayor invites King to the city to try to calm things down. And King gets to the city and basically is like, you need a civilian complaint review board. You need to basically fire the cop. I mean, and the mayor totally ignores him. But this notion that King is sort of separate from the kinds of calls that we are talking about today just is not borne out when you actually look at what King is doing and how he talks about the police. Let me read you one more thing. And this is from 64, right? This is not 67 King. This is 64. Armies of officials are clothed in uniform, invested with authority, armed with the instruments of violence and death, and conditioned to believe that they can intimidate, maim, or kill Negroes with the same recklessness that once motivated the slave owner.
Wow. Wow.
So he's very much thinking about the role that the police play, not just racist Bull Connor or racist Jim Clark, right? But the role the police play in society. So I think that's really important. The second thing I think where I want us to think about in terms of Black Lives Matter is I think we often forget that at the heart of King's belief in nonviolent direct action is a belief in disruption and the need for disruption, right? And I think we've made him into this like passive hand-holding, like, I don't even know. And he's very clear that in some sense, part of what nonviolent direct action is supposed to do is it's supposed to upset, like in some sense, injustice is comfortable. And so just to give you one of my favorite examples, just because it is such a direct parallel to today, in 1964, Brooklyn Core, the chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, they had been organizing for years. They'd been organizing around housing segregation, around job discrimination, around school desegregation. You know, they'd managed to win like 2 jobs at Ebenezer's Bakery, and they'd managed to get 1 family into a different school, right? So all these token things. And so by 1964, they are really fed up. And 1964 is the year of the World's Fair here in New York City. And so Brooklyn Core decides that they're going to escalate their tactics, and they are going to call for a stall in on the highway going out to Flushing Meadows, which is where the World's Fair is going to be held. Now, this obviously sounds familiar, right? To things, and people go nuts. I mean, white leaders, Black moderate leaders, the, you know, Robert Moses of, you know, New York, and this is a horrible, horrible idea. This is terrible. And they try to get King to come out against this idea. And King refuses. And I'm just going to read you what he writes. "We do not need allies who are more devoted to order than to justice." And again, this is calling for a highway stalling. "I hear a lot of talk these days," King writes, "about how our direct action talk alienates former friends. I would rather feel they're bringing to the surface latent prejudices that are already there. If our direct action programs alienate our friends, they never were really our friends."
Yes.
And so I think, I mean, and I can give you lots of other examples, but I mean, I think at the base of those examples is his understanding that nonviolent direct action is has to be disruptive. It has to make people uncomfortable. It's not about making people love you. It's about making people uncomfortable enough to be changed and move to action. And it's not about like one big group hug, right? And that's how you get changed. No. And so I think that's the other way that I think he's really misused, because I think there's often this sense of like with Black Lives Matter, you're not doing it the right way, you're not using the right tactics, when in fact, most of the criticism of Black Lives Matter are criticisms that are waged against King and the civil rights movement for being reckless, for being, you know, like out of control, for being aggressive, for being disruptive. All of those things are waged against King as well, even though that's not how we remember.
That's right. Oh, there was so much there. Thank you. I guess what I just took away from what you just said that I hadn't fully processed was the radical ideas that King had early on in the struggle.
Yes.
I guess I had also thought about him coming to radical conclusions.
Yep.
Certainly the last year of his life, all sorts of radical statements are being made, but you digging out that quote from 1964 really just puts lie to everybody trying to use him to moderate the struggle today. So really.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, let me give you one more example, just because we're on the topic of schools, right? So one of the tactics that Northern movements start to use by the early 60s, right? Because they're trying to get desegregation in New York, in Chicago, in Boston, right? And they're getting all this resistance. Oh, we don't have segregation here. Oh, we don't even keep track of it. Oh, this would require busing. We don't like busing, right? And so one of the tactics you see Northern movements turning to by 63 and 64, as we know, is the school boycott, right? Happens in the fall of 63 in Chicago. The biggest civil rights protest, we've talked about this in these sessions before, happens, not the March on Washington, but happens in New York City in February 1964, where almost 500,000 students and teachers stay out of school to protest the fact that we're 10 years after Brown. And there's still not even a comprehensive plan for desegregation in New York City, let alone actual desegregation. So again, King supporting the school boycott in Chicago, supporting the school boycott in New York, supporting the school boycott in Boston. And there's all these critics, right? And the New York Times, all these, you know, the Chicago Tribune, they hate this, right? And so 2 months later, King, in a column in the Amsterdam News, comes out again in favor of the school boycott and really is taking some of these critics on. The school boycott in practice has proved very effective, he writes, in uncovering the injustice and indignity that school children in the Negro Puerto Rican minority communities face. School boycotts have punctured the thin veneer of the North's racial self-righteousness. This is 64. This is the spring of 64, pre-passage of the Civil Rights Act. School boycotts have punctured, I'm going to read it again. Have punctured the thin veneer of the North's racial self-righteousness. Responding to the criticism that these disruptive tactics alienate well-meaning allies, King made clear, the truth of the matter is that it is the harvest of past apathy to tragic conditions that were allowed to exist without any serious concern. So basically he's like, this has been happening and you're getting all upset with this tactic. And the reason you are is because you have let this problem go on.
Wow. Brilliant analysis and also beautiful language. Thank you for sharing his direct quotes there. I love the way he condemns the Northern structural racism in the schools. And you know, King is widely celebrated, but only a very narrow part of what he said is lifted up in the mainstreams. Like four words from his speech at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom are often repeated, right? I have a dream, but not his more radical views, such as when he said, something is wrong with capitalism. There must be a better distribution of wealth, and maybe America must move towards democratic socialism. So I'm hoping you could talk about his economic vision, his views on unions and class.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we want to go back to the March on Washington speech and where it begins. And where it begins is him talking about America giving Black people a bad check. And again, many of us might not use checks anymore, right? But he's sort of saying, basically, they've come there, they refuse to believe, and again, I'm paraphrasing him, that, you know, that this, they're gonna, this, they've defaulted on this promissory note, but they've come to collect, right? And what we know about a bad check is that the only way to write a bad check is to put another check, right? You have to have a good check. You don't get to just apologize, say, I'm sorry, I gave you a bad check, I didn't mean it, right? You have to give people a good check. And so to me, in that most iconic speech, is King saying, we are here for material redress, right? We're not, like, that's what it's gonna take, right? And mm-hmm. So I think the kind of fundamental idea that, like, that both, I mean, we could talk about that in terms of reparations. We could talk about the harm being not just a kind of moral harm, but a kind of economic exploitation. Certainly he understood segregation to be, you know, I think again, in the way that we tended to sort of see his critique of segregation being about meanness or about, like, people not wanting to sit next to each other. And he very much talks about it in terms of profit, in terms of how much money is being made and also taken out of the, you know, taken out of the Black community. And I think we miss, again, what we might call kind of the kind of racial capitalism, like, argument that King is making, right? So he understands. And yes, so he's assassinated, he's building a poor people's campaign, right? One of the last things he's working on at the end is bringing together, right? What, you know, he's talking about the three evils, right? Of, like, sort of poverty and racism and militarism. And he's building a kind of interracial poor people's campaign when he's assassinated, that will be continued by his, you know, friends and colleagues that summer. And again, the vision, and then it's being just a, you know, it's continuing in a new version, a new poor people's campaign today that's being co-chaired actually by my sister and Reverend Barber. And so, yes, this vision was where he was at the end of his life, right? That we need to kind of attack these three things in tandem. And that you can't not talk about militarism, because in fact, this is the constant argument used to sort of say we can't pay for these other things, right? And so King is talking about the ways that that becomes a, you know, a way to also deform and distort our society.
Yeah, totally. And I love that there's a new poor people's campaign, and that's really the way to honor Martin Luther King today. If you want to check out that campaign and get active in that, not this nonsense from the right. We just have a couple minutes before we are going to move to breakout sessions and have everyone here meet in small groups to talk about what they've learned in this session. But I want to ask you one more question before we move to the breakout sessions. And that is more about your new book that you're working on now. Because the civil rights movement is generally taught as a Southern phenomenon. And yet, as you pointed out earlier, some of the biggest protests of that era were actually in the North.
Right.
And in your new book on King, you're focusing on Martin Luther King's work in the North.
Right.
And so I'm hoping you can speak about what that work looked like and what he thought about Northern liberals.
Right. So I kind of came to this work, it started a while ago. I was working on this, like, research on the civil rights movement in LA pre the Watts uprising. And I kept finding Dr. King. And I was like, wait a minute, this is not the story I was taught. The story I was taught was that King kind of turns his attention to, like, you know, LA and problems after Watts. And King is in LA, like, at least 15 times in the late 50s and early 60s. And he's
standing with movements around school segregation. He's standing with movements around against police brutality. He's standing with movements fighting housing segregation. So it's not just like he's just there raising money for the South. And so that's kind of where this journey began. And just realizing how much this argument then makes King, it distances us from him. Because I think that one of the ways, if you are forced to see that King actually sees racism structural, he sees that it's not a Southern kind of aberration, but kind of fundamental to the nation, that he's constantly from the beginning critiquing Northern liberals who point to Mississippi, but aren't sort of dealing with job discrimination or housing segregation in their own community. And he's constantly talking about that. And one of the things I realized that I hadn't paid attention to is that King actually spends these formative years of kind of young adulthood in the North, right? So we sort of know his biography, right? He goes to Morehouse early, right? He starts at Morehouse when he's 16. So he graduates Morehouse at 19. And then he goes on, and it's at Morehouse that he gets his religious calling, because he didn't necessarily think he wanted to follow in his father's footsteps, because he found it too kind of emotional and not tied to kind of the world. And then he found a kind of path, a calling, a religious calling that where he could blend those two. So he decides to go to divinity school, and he goes to divinity school at Crozier Seminary in Pennsylvania. So he spends 3 years at Crozier, and then he goes on to get his doctorate at Boston University. And so he basically spends from like age 19 to 25 in the North, and confronting not just like a promised land, but also kind of the racism of the North. So for instance, when King moves to Boston, so he's like 21, 22, he has huge trouble finding anybody who will rent to him. And he talks about the incredible housing segregation that he encounters there. A year before, in 1950, he and some friends go out for drinks across the border from where he's in seminary in New Jersey, in Maple Shade, New Jersey. The owner refuses to serve them. They protest. They say, hey, New Jersey has an anti-discrimination law. The owner gets a gun and like basically threatens them with gunpoint and kicks them out. And so they're outraged. They go back. They think about filing, because there's New Jersey has an anti-discrimination law in the books. And these three white University of Pennsylvania law students offer to help, because they go and test the place. They're served. But then when push comes to shove, those white University of Pennsylvania students back out. And so they won't testify. And the case kind of falls apart. And so King's own personal experiences, and I could go on, in the North are both showing him kind of the racism of the North, but they're also showing him the kind of limits of Northern liberalism, the limits of anti-discrimination law, the limits of people who say that they're your allies. They, you know, allies kind of get flat, you know, flabby. And so to me, part of our story begins there, so that he never then, when he moves from Boston, right, to takes his first job in Montgomery. And that's when we meet him. And that's when he starts to step into this leadership role. But he comes to that with 6 years of kind of becoming an adult, becoming who he is as an intellectual, who he is as a religious leader in the North. And so there is never a moment when King is not writing about also the North. In his first book on Montgomery, right, Stride Toward Freedom, he is also calling out Northern liberals and the need for Northern liberals to be liberal at home and not just look at the South. That is there from, you know, from the very beginning. And so I think just seeing that coming out of King's own experience, I think has also, you know, and the ways that we tend to see that experience and kind of miss its import, I think, is really kind of significant.
Yes. Oh, that's so useful. I think a lot of lesson plans are going to be sharper after this talk. Thank you so much for sharing that. And so while we are waiting for questions to come in from the group here. I'll get things going with one question for you, Gene. I was hoping you could talk more about how King developed his radical ideas about racial capitalism, about the police, about imperialism, about Black liberation, right? Who were his mentors and his teachers and experiences that led him to those conclusions?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I think we want to remember how young King is in Montgomery, right? So he is still in formation, right? He is 26 years old, you know, that morning, December 2nd, right? When he gets the call from E.D. Nixon that the Women's Political Council is planning a boycott for Monday and they're trying to get the ministers on board and they want to use King's Church. If anybody's ever been to Montgomery, right? King's Church, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church is like really centrally located in Montgomery. It's right next to the Capitol. So they want to use King's Church for this meeting to get the ministers on board. And King basically says that morning, the Kings have a three-week-old baby, their first baby. They've just had her. And he hesitates and he says, can you call me back? Just like any of the rest of us would at 6 a.m. And so I always like to start there because I think we sometimes assume that King just is, you know, he just knows what to do or he's just destined or whatever. And I think that this Jesse's question about learning, I think, takes us in a different direction, right? Which is that King is in process and he's going to have to make decisions and he's going to have to sort of step into this role. And part of how he steps into this role is by one of the things that I've come to see again in this research for this new book is, you know, he's doing all of this traveling, he's speaking all over the country, but in doing so, he's also hooking up with all of these different like local movements in all these places. And learning from them, right? And one of the people he's learning from is Bayard Rustin, right? And people might know Rustin from, Rustin's one of the key organizers of the 1963 March on Washington. Rustin is a socialist, he's a journalist, he's a pacifist. And he's one of King's key kind of interlocutors, both in like kind of from the Montgomery bus boycott till 1960. And then Adam Clayton Powell, people may know this, like threatens to say that Adam Clayton Powell doesn't like that King is learning from Rustin, and King and Rustin in some sense embody a different kind of masculinity than Powell, right? It's a kind of nonviolent but confrontational, right? And Powell is like a politician, backroom dealer, right? And so this, he doesn't like how much influence Rustin has in terms of this kind of the ways that King is sort of turning into a leader is again, this like a much different kind of race man, if we're going to use that term. And so people may know Powell threatens to say that Rustin and King are having an affair. And even though they're not having an affair, King gets scared and Rustin offers to kind of pull back and King takes him up on it. So for a while, then King and Rustin's relationship kind of fades. And then we see that it kind of grows again around the March on Washington. And he will be very important in terms of King's thinking in kind of 64 and 65. And then again, they kind of part ways because Rustin gets more pragmatic and King gets more radical. So Rustin is a key person who's shaping King's ideas. But I guess another thing I want us to be thinking about is just how it's shaping King's ideas to be traveling around the country, seeing all these different movements, and in some sense growing like from that knowledge, right? So sort of seeing what people are trying, seeing what's not, what's working, but also seeing in many ways, particularly how much resistance there is in the North that looks different than the South, right? It's not necessarily, the Klan. It's not necessarily burning crosses. Sometimes it's violent. Sometimes it's bureaucratic, right? Sometimes it's using the levers of power. But to think about King always kind of learning and to think about King as an intellectual whose journey, I mean, basically he's 26 when it starts and he's 39 when he's assassinated.
right? And so he's learning, and in some sense, part of King's genius is his ability to constantly keep thinking things over and turning things over and reshaping things. And I think we miss that aspect of King, and King is like a kind of dynamic kind of thinker and political strategist or activist.
Yeah, I love that description of how he was constantly in motion with his ideas and learning and developing, rather than what we often, the image that often gets portrayed of fully formed Messiah.
Right, right.
And, you know, some of my favorite artists too never got stuck in one period, right? Like, I love how Miles Davis freaked everybody out with fusion jazz, or Bob Dylan like freaked out his audience too. Like, we change and develop and grow. And I really like that description. We have some really good questions coming in the chat that we can move to. Somebody asked why the narrative that Dr. King's radicalism was gradual and post-Watts.
Mm-hmm. So I think part of this is a kind of media and kind of thinking about the role of the media in the civil rights movement. And I think, again, there we have a kind of too simplistic narrative, because I think there's this, the media plays a very important role in shining a light on the Southern civil rights movement. And there's a, you know, John Lewis will talk about the role of the media, like we would have been a bird without wings. And certainly there are some really key moments, particularly if we think about the Freedom Rides or the sit-ins or some, you know, or the what happens on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, right? That the media then shines a light on those things in a sustained way that then begins to change the United States. But that same media, right, is based in the North. And tends to take a very different tone when covering civil rights issues at home. And so this is another thing that I've gotten very interested in this new project, is the ways that I've been looking, for instance, at the ways the New York Times covers the movement in Birmingham in 63 versus the ways it's covering King, either when he's doing, you know, when he's doing other things. So one of the funniest things I found, and I should say, Jesse had mentioned this at the beginning, but when we send out the recording of this session, we're also going to send out the materials of this session, and we'll include an article I wrote, which is the sort of beginnings of this book project I'm working on. But recently, I found this piece that we all remember, right, in September of 63, right? The 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham gets bombed, and the four sort of pre-teenage young women get killed. And one of King's first responses to this, which I had not remembered, is to call for a nationwide boycott of Christmas shopping. That he is so angry, but he is also like, this is not just a Birmingham problem, this is an American problem, and this is, you know, and the New York Times goes crazy. And they write this editorial, and we could send it out because it's the craziest thing. I mean, and basically it's like war on Christmas kind of thing. It's you know, it's like
they accuse him of waging a war on Christmas.
Yes. And that basically he's doing the same thing that these people who had bombed the church would be doing. And it would be turning Christmas into a day of hate if they did that. And I mean, it's insane. But I think it gets at the ways that the media is going to shape how we understand who King is and what he's doing and what he's not doing. So I think part of this idea of King turning his attention to the North after Watts is because the media turns its attention to the North after Watts in ways that it tended to sort of not want to cover the civil rights movement in New York like a movement in the ways that it was covering the movement in Birmingham by 63, for instance.
That's a great point.
A product of the time. And then I think King makes strategic use. One of the things that I came to realize also is like you know, so this point of like how he's been in LA so many times and he's been talking about police brutality before 65, he's talking about all these things, but that shock after Watts, like he's strategic. He's using that shock to open up more space to talk about things he'd been trying to talk about for years, right? He realizes there's more space. And so he's also using it. And there, in some sense, these papers are willing to give him a lot more space to talk about these things and to listen to things he's been saying for a long time, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's really important. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it quite that way. That's very useful. More questions coming in. Someone says they would like to hear more of a discussion about the international connections of Dr. King's work. And someone else said they would love to hear more about the internationalist nature of his stance and how that relates to current Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think a couple of things. So one of the things that they do, he and Coretta do shortly after the end of the Montgomery bus boycott, is they go to India, right? And so they begin to sort of make these international connections. But I think one of the things, and I've talked about this a little at previous sessions, so maybe people have heard me say this before, but I mean, I think when we want to talk about King's international, we really have to begin with Coretta Scott King, because she's the internationalist in many ways. For, you know, like she comes to their marriage, right, with a more kind of international vision already. She supports Henry Wallace's third party candidacy in 1948 for the presidency, right? Wallace is running on a pro-peace, anti-segregation third party platform. Right, so she's in some sense kind of more political even than King is when they meet. In the early 1960s, she starts to get involved in kind of international women's peace act like actions. She goes to Geneva in 1962 around kind of global peace and kind of issues. She joins the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And interestingly, when he wins the Nobel Prize in 1964, she really sees this as they now have a different responsibility, that their responsibility has shifted from just being kind of to the United States to the world. And she talks about, you know, starting to kind of like talk to him and in some sense, like pressure maybe is not the right word, but to say, you know, you have to start kind of coming out against US involvement in Vietnam more publicly. You know, that this, we now have this responsibility to the world. And, you know, this is a very costly stand. She comes out publicly earlier than him. So she's speaking out against the war at various events in 65. A journalist then asks him, did you educate her? He says, no, she educated me. And we know then that he by 67, he is very out publicly. And he certainly opposed the war long before 1967. But I think really thinking about his internationalism really coming from, in part learning from her, I think really, and that kind of vision that she has and those experiences that she's having is really important.
No doubt. And,
yeah.
No doubt. Yeah. Just the way that Black women in general are erased from the telling of the Black freedom struggle all mm-hmm. too often. And then mm-hmm. specifically how the monumental role Coretta plays in the developing of King's politics is so important. So thank you for adding that in. We got some more great questions coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Wilson has a question, says, I had a chat with Reverend Jim Lawson last year, and he brought up an idea that I had been thinking about and that I think needs more research for our recent history. Lawson suggested that following the LBJ Democratic Party's reluctant backing of civil rights caused an anti-democratic small d backlash against racial progress that turned into a general anti-government movement, which is really what led to January 6th. In other words, racism drove what we are now seeing in the radical white extremists who see government itself as the enemy. I wonder what you think of that.
Well, you know, I think I would like to take this in a slightly different direction. And this is partly because my head is in the North, which is that the other aspect I think we need to think about, because I think we tend to have this like Nixon Southern strategy idea about like basically that Nixon and the new right will kind of find this Southern, you know, what they call, you know, what is what, you know, scholars have termed the Southern strategy, which is to sort of to like speak of racial politics, but not as like vehemently and outwardly, right? And so, and then that's how you then move this group of moderate white working class and middle class people, right, to the right. But I actually think the origins of that are not in the South, but in the North. And that I think what we need to see is that, when we see King talking about Northern liberalism or calling out Northerners, I think one of the things we see there is that, and what one of the things he's recognizing is, okay, these allies might be willing to change the South, but they are not willing to change where they are. And if you make them change where they are, if you even start to talk about that, you're going to get this backlash, right? And so he's very much, one of the interesting things that he starts getting, for instance, in 64, people talking about this Wallace backlash, and, you know, it's so surprising that Wallace has this support outside the South. And then he's like, it's always been there. And he's constantly talking about this, and that people have not recognized that there is this anti-civil rights strand in the North, right? That is that, again, comes out when the change gets too close to home. That there's a sort of like larger kind of commitment to civil rights, but then when it actually involves like school desegregation at home, no. When it actually involves like changing your own like housing or, you know, no. And so I actually think what we need to spend more time thinking about is that the ways that this racial politics that we tend to sort of associate with, you know, whatever Reagan Democrats or the Southern strategy comes out of, in some sense, these Northerners in the early 60s, right, who might, again, be willing to say Mississippi is a horrible racist place and we should fix that, but are absolutely saying no to school desegregation here in New York City. And I think there's the question of like this right wing, but I think I guess I'm wanting to think about this middle and the ways that we've kind of misunderstood the kind of racial politics of the middle as the South driving it, when I think that's too simplistic.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I like the way you frame that. Thank you. Yeah, more questions coming in. I just want to tell people that please don't leave before filling out the evaluation that Deborah has dropped in the chat. So if you have to drop off, please make sure you fill that out before you go. But we have just a few more minutes for a couple last questions. If you can stick with us, that would be great. Somebody else asked, let's see, maybe I'll throw a couple together. I don't know if you know anything about what King said about the earth, environmentalism, materialism. That was one of the questions. And then another one is asking about what King would be doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have maybe one more question for you after that.
So I don't know about King and environmentalism, although again, my recent research suggests that there's probably so much to find, because again, I just have been amazed at how much, you know, and again, I really suggest that people use King Day to go back to and read King, because I feel like the more I read him, the more I'm like, wow, there's all these things that I, you know, that even boxes I was putting him in that you just have to like get rid of the, you know.
Yeah.
What would he be doing today?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things is how uncomfortable King made people, right? How unpopular he was. And I think there's something humbling about that, right? Which is that, like, I think, you know, all these papers are editorializing against him. All of these, you know, like, they all come out against him when he comes out against Vietnam, right? They all are criticizing, and again, earlier than that too. So what it means to have to kind of keep going in the midst of that kind of like public disapproval and hatred. The last time King and Parks see each other, she's living in Detroit. He comes to this very fancy suburb of Detroit called Grosse Pointe, a month before he's assassinated. He talks about this as the most disruptive indoor audience he ever experienced. He's heckled so much that night. He's called a traitor so much that night. She talks about what a mess it was. They're so afraid that he's going to be assassinated that night that the police chief sits on King's lap. King is not a tall man. The police chief sits on his lap and they drive him into the school he's speaking at in Grosse Pointe because they're worried he's going to be killed. So what it means to just like be confronting that level of like opposition and hatred, like all the time. I think one of the things about where King would be today, right, is I think he would be making people uncomfortable in the ways that he was making people uncomfortable in 1968 or 1963 or 1958, right? And that he believed in like disruptive politics. Again, like it wasn't just like, I don't know. I think sometimes again, going back to where we started our conversation about kind of policing and one of the things I just have been forced to think about a lot that I just really hadn't was just like Dr. King's body, right? And what it means that he kept putting himself and his body in jeopardy in some sense in all of these arrests, right?
Yeah.
And just thinking about what it takes to do that. And, you know, with this understanding that he, you know, that they just, you know, and having your body like touched and manhandled in all the ways that like his body was touched and manhandled by police. And so just thinking about the actual person.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that. You're absolutely right. He would be disrupting things along with the disruptors of the 2020 uprising. And I just love the way you always point out that those who try to create a dichotomy between Black Lives Matter and the uprising and Martin Luther King really don't understand the legacy of arrests that he was committed to using to disrupt injustice. So that's great. And you mentioned his meeting there with Rosa Parks, and I thought maybe we would just end with one last question about his relationship with Rosa Parks, who you have written so extensively about, and I would just love to hear more about how these two most celebrated figures of the civil rights movement are often both misunderstood and mistaught. And you have a new film coming out, which I'm so excited to see, about Rosa Parks. So people here should definitely be ready to see that, to teach with it, and share it with others. So I'm hoping you can talk about Rosa and Martin Luther King's relationship and Rosa's attitude towards Martin Luther King. And then we have a last evaluation for folks and some last announcements.
Thank you. So what Jesse's referring to is, right, there's a documentary being sort of made and finalized right now, kind of based on my book. The film is also going to be called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, based on my book. And so it's just been amazing to get to see her life come alive on the screen. I think, so she gets disgusted later in life about the ways that he's getting like misused and misunderstood. And just like, and she's there, like, there's this funny quote from her where it's, she's also like, he's not just constantly dreaming, he was acting, right? And like, just like the ways that, you know, so she starts pushing for a holiday like many other activists, right? From the moment he's assassinated, right? And she's doing all this stuff. There's this great photo of her the next year on the first anniversary where she has this like huge bullhorn and she's wearing this like almost like a cowboy hat or something. I don't know, some sort of funny hat. And so she pushes for this holiday, but then she also comes to see the way that he's getting stripped of who he was. So that's interesting. So that's later in life. I mean, she talks about, and one of the things, again, in thinking about King as like an actual person. So he, you know, he comes to Montgomery, he's 25, to pastor at his first church. And he comes to an NAACP meeting, and this he speaks one night, this is right after the Brown decision. So, and she just is like flabbergasted because he's just such a good speaker, and he's so young, right? And if, I mean, he's 25, and then, you know, he looks like he's maybe, you know, if you look at what King looks like, I mean, he just looks so young, and she is just so proud. So she's 42 at this point, or 41 maybe when she first meets him. And so she's like, they're not exactly peers, right? Like, they're not the same age. King has graduate degrees. Rosa Parks doesn't get to go to college. They're not, you know, she's working class. He's sort of more middle class. But she's just so proud of him. And it is so, you know, you kind of get to, like, when you see him through her eyes, right? It's like watching this young man kind of turn into this like incredible national leader, and just like watching it before your eyes, right? And just to get to, and again, I think it reminds us again that King is like a real person, right? And again, making choices and figuring it out, and just like how remarkable it is.
Well, that's so wonderful. Such a great place to wrap up this conversation. Thank you so much, Gene, and thanks to everybody who's here with us.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. Yeah.